Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
A new public opinion study suggests a big majority of Americans believe that the spread of misinformation is a problem. Most also think social media companies and the people who use them are largely to blame. But fewer think that they themselves might be responsible. These findings came in a poll released Friday by the Pearson Institute and the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. In the study, 95% of Americans said misinformation was a problem when trying to find important information. About half put a lot of blame on the U.S. government. And about 75% said social media users and technology companies were responsible. Only 2 in 10 Americans said they are very concerned that they had personally spread misinformation. And 6 in 10 were at least somewhat concerned that their friends or family members had been part of the problem. Carmen Speller is a 33-year-old graduate student in Lexington, Kentucky. She has disagreements with her family over COVID-19 vaccines. She trusts the vaccines, but her family does not. She believes her family has seen misinformation on TV or read it on news websites, and that has led them to stay unvaccinated. Some of Speller's family members think she is crazy for trusting the government for information about COVID-19. I do feel like they believe I'm misinformed. I'm the one that's blindly following what the government is saying. That's something I hear a lot, Speller said. Speller is not the only one who may be having disagreements with her family. The study suggests that 61% of Republican Party members say the U.S. government has a lot of responsibility for spreading misinformation. 38% of Democratic Party members feel the same way. There is more agreement, however, about the part that social media companies, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, should play. The poll found that 79% of Republicans and 73% of Democrats said social media companies hold a lot of responsibility for misinformation. That kind of agreement among Americans could be a problem for big social media companies like Facebook. Facebook has recently faced a lot of criticism from both Republican and Democratic lawmakers. Konstantin Sonin is a professor of public policy at the University of Chicago. He works with the Pearson Institute. Sonin said the poll is bad news for Facebook. It makes clear that assaulting Facebook is popular by a large margin, even when Congress is split 50-50, and each side has its own reasons, he said. The poll also suggested that Americans are willing to blame others, but not themselves for the situation. 53% of them said they are not concerned that they have spread misinformation. We see this a lot of times where people are very worried about misinformation, but they think it's something that happens to other people. Other people get fooled by it. Other people spread it, said Lisa Fazio. She is a Vanderbilt University psychology professor. Fazio studies how false claims spread. Most people don't recognize their own role in it, she said. I'm Dan Novak.
A Danish artist is seeking to get back his sculpture in Hong Kong that memorializes the victims of China's 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. The deadline for its removal passed on Wednesday. The artist, Jens Galschut, said in an email that he hopes to bring the sculpture out of Hong Kong under orderly conditions and without it having suffered from any damage. Last week, Hong Kong University demanded the removal of the artwork, Pillar of Shame, by Wednesday morning. The university said in an emailed statement, "We are still seeking legal advice and working with related parties to handle the matter in a legal and reasonable manner." However, an activist group, the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements of China, released a letter from lawyers representing the university. The letter said the artwork would be considered abandoned if it were not taken away by the deadline. Galschut had loaned Pillar of Shame to the group. The group was broken up last month as officials suppressed political activism in Hong Kong. The sculpture has been in place for 24 years. China's leaders sent in the military to end pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 1989. Hundreds or possibly thousands of people died in the crackdown. The ruling Communist Party has since barred any public discussion or memorializing of the events in mainland China. For years, people in Hong Kong held memorial observations there. But Hong Kong officials have banned such gatherings for the past 2 years. They said concerns over COVID-19 were the reason for the ban. Galschut told the Associated Press that he wants the sculpture to remain in Hong Kong. But as a second choice, he said, the artwork could be placed elsewhere until it can be brought back to the city or another area in China. We don't exactly know where we should put it, but we think we have a possibility in Taiwan. We have a possibility in the United States, in Washington, D.C., maybe in front of the Chinese embassy, and in Europe, he said. The artist said last week that it would take time to move the sculpture. He expressed concern that the short deadline set by the university meant officials looked to destroy it. It's an attack against the art. And it's an attack against the memory about the Tiananmen crackdown, he said at the time. Galschut said his lawyer had sent a letter Tuesday requesting a hearing on the issue. The artist added, I would like to emphasize that I consider any damage to the sculpture to be the responsibility of the university. I'm Katie Weaver.
Swiss researchers say they have completed the most detailed virtual reality map of the universe ever created. The map permits users to travel through space and time, the researchers said in a recent statement. It can be imagined as a kind of Google Earth, but for the universe. The map was created by a team at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. With the help of VR headsets, users can visit places in the universe virtually. This includes the International Space Station, the Moon, Saturn, and faraway exoplanets. The software program is called the Virtual Reality Universe Project, or VRUP. The researchers said they combined the largest data set of information about the universe to create the three-dimensional experience. People can see the virtual universe through VR equipment or with 3D glasses in a theater. A personal computer can also be used to see the universe in a non-3D way. Jean-Paul Kneipp is the director of EPFL's Astrophysics Laboratory. He told the Associated Press, one of the best parts of the project was putting together parts of the data set into one framework. You can see the universe at different scales, nearby us, around the Earth, around the solar system, at the Milky Way level, Kneipp said. To see through the universe and time up to the beginning, what we call the Big Bang. Many scientists believe the Big Bang is the explosion that created the universe. VRUP produces images that can appear as close as 1 meter or seemingly at an infinite distance. It is available to everyone for free, but does require at least a computer and is best experienced with VR equipment that can also show 3D images. It aims to get many kinds of visitors. This includes both scientists looking to get a virtual picture of the data they collect and people seeking a new way to explore the universe. The software has been released in its first or beta version. This version can run on personal computers, but not Mac computers from Apple. Downloading the software and content can be difficult for less skilled computer users. Users seeking the best experience will also need a powerful computer with a lot of storage. There are different versions of the software. A smaller version is aimed at the public, and a larger one is meant for scientists or astronomy experts. The project combines information from 8 databases. It includes at least 4,500 known exoplanets, tens of millions of galaxies, and hundreds of millions of space objects. More than 1.5 billion light-producing objects from the Milky Way alone are included. The researchers expect to continually add data, meaning the virtual experience will keep getting better with time. Future databases could include space rocks called asteroids in our solar system or farther objects in our galaxy. Yves Rivat is an astrophysicist with the EPFL who spoke to the AP about the effort. He called the system a very efficient way of visiting all the different scales that compose our universe. Riva added, "A very important part of this project is that it's a first step toward treating much larger data sets which are coming." I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we reported in our last program, slavery supporters failed to push through Congress a bill to make Kansas a slave state. Congress instead let the people of Kansas vote on the statehood constitution, written by pro-slavery men. The people rejected the Constitution, and slavery supporters gave up the fight for Kansas. Here are Steve Ember and Bob Doty to continue the story.
The problem of slavery continued to divide the North and South. Northerners warned that slavery could spread no farther. Southerners threatened to leave the Union unless Southern rights were protected. In the far West, one could forget this bitter dispute. There were no slaves in the West. The land and the weather were not right for the kind of farming that used slaves.
The West was growing quickly. Gold had brought thousands of settlers to California 10 years earlier. New discoveries of gold and silver now were leading men to Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada. "Don't go," warned the New York Tribune, "if you have a job or a farm. But if you have neither," it said, "and can get $50, then go to Colorado." There were many men without jobs or farms in the summer of 1858. The country had suffered a serious economic depression the year before, and jobs were difficult to find. Thousands left cities in the East. The first ones to reach Colorado reported that gold was easy to find. They said any man who worked hard could find $5 to $10 worth of gold a day, and sometimes even more.
The thousands who rushed to Colorado soon found that there was not as much gold as expected. The valuable metal became harder to find. No longer could it be washed from the bottoms of mountain streams. Men had to dig into the mountains of rock to get it. Huge digging machines and crushers were needed to get the gold from the rock. These machines were expensive. Few men had enough money to buy them. Some of the miners organized companies. They borrowed money from Eastern banks or sold shares of their companies. In a few years, almost all of the gold from Colorado came from the mining companies.
Many of those who went west to search for gold stayed to become farmers or storekeepers. Others moved farther west to find gold in Nevada or California. Some cleared the ground of trees and cut them into wood for houses. Such timber from the forests of Oregon and Washington was sold in California and Mexico, even in China and Hawaii. A few men recognized the need for transportation across the nation. Engineers planned four railroads, but northern and southern leaders could not agree on which one to build first. Until a railroad could be built, supplies were carried west in wagons, pulled by horses or oxen. Three men, Russell, Majors, and Waddell, formed a transportation company in 1855 to carry government supplies to soldiers in the West. They started with 500 wagons. 3 years later, the company had 3,500 wagons and 40,000 oxen.
Getting letters to and from the West was not easy in the 1850s. Ships brought mail to San Francisco two times a month. And once each month, mail would arrive in California after a slow trip by wagon from St. Louis, Missouri. The federal government decided to send mail overland two times a week to California. It gave the job of carrying the letters to a new company, the Overland Mail Company. The mail was carried by train or boat to St. Louis. Then it was put on Overland Company stage coaches, light wagons pulled by four or six horses. The company was told to take the mail along a 4,000-kilometer southern route through Arkansas, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The mail arrived in Los Angeles 24 days after it left St. Louis.
There was a shorter way across the country, but the postal chief was a Southerner, A.V. Brown. He believed stagecoach travel might lead the way for a railroad, and he wanted a southern railroad to California. Brown said the southern route was the only one that could be kept open in all seasons. He said the other routes would be closed by snow in winter. The overland stagecoaches were large enough to carry four passengers, but not many people went to California in the coaches. The coaches never stopped for very long, only to change horses or drivers. And there were not many places to eat. Also, the trip was dangerous because of hostile Indians.
The shortest distance between Missouri and California was across the central part of the country. The Russell, Majors, and Waddell Company decided to show that this central route could be used all year. It began a speedy mail service called the Pony Express. Letters were carried by riders on fast horses. Stations with fresh horses were built about 24 kilometers apart all along the way. A rider would change horses at each station until he had traveled 120 kilometers. Then he would give his letters to another rider. In this way, the letters would be carried between California and Missouri. The first letters sent by Pony Express from California took 10 days to reach Missouri. The Pony Express lasted only 18 months. It was no longer needed after a telegraph line was completed to San Francisco.
As communications and transportation improved, the government was able to increase its control over the West. But closer ties were not welcomed between the government and a religious group known as the Mormons. The Mormon religion was started by a young New England man named Joseph Smith. In 1823, at the age of 18, Smith claimed that an angel told him of a golden book. He said the book contained God's words to the ancient people of America. Smith said he was able to read the strange writing in this book and put it into English. He called this work the Book of Mormon.
He organized a church and made himself its leader. Many people became Mormons. They believed themselves to be a special people chosen by God. Mormons worked hard. They helped each other and shared with those in need. People who did not agree with the beliefs of the Mormons did not like them. Trouble developed between Mormons and other people. Joseph Smith was forced to move his people from New York to Ohio and then to Missouri. The Mormons seemed finally to have found a home in Illinois. They built their own town and called it Nauvoo. They governed themselves and had their own defense force. The Mormons did so well that Nauvoo became the fastest growing city in Illinois. Then some members of the group split apart because of a new message Smith claimed to have received from God. Smith said God gave permission for Mormons to have more than one wife. This was polygamy, and it was opposed by almost all people. Some of the Mormons who left the church published a newspaper criticizing Smith and the other Mormon leaders. Followers ordered by Smith destroyed the newspaper's publishing equipment. This caused non-Mormons to demonstrate and demand that Smith be punished. Smith was arrested and put in jail in Carthage, Illinois. His brother also was arrested. An angry mob attacked the jail and shot both Smith and his brother to death. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave his state. He said only this would prevent further violence. There was no choice. They had to leave. The Mormons had a new leader, Brigham Young. Young decided to take his people west and find a new home for them. He wanted a place where they would be safe, where no one could interfere with their religion. Brigham Young told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said they would search for it in the west, for a wide, beautiful valley. He said he would recognize it when he saw it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.